Hi, podcast listeners. Tonight we have a fascinating program because on the heels of continued US-China trade talks, we are digging down into the human rights aspect and how China is massively expanding into a surveillance state and how technology is playing a massive role. First, a great report from correspondent Matt Rivers onto how that's being used against the Uyghurs, China's minority Muslim population, and then a deeper dive with the New York Times tech correspondent Paul Mosher on China's technology into surveillance and how it's using it and exporting it as well. Afterwards, we talked to Jared Diamond, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author, who's discussing crises and how some countries are more resilient than others when it comes to handling crises. Diamond's a polymath. He's a biologist, a geographer, a linguist, and a historian. And finally, our Michelle Martin sits down with the actress Maddie Corman to find out how she's dealing with her husband, who's a convicted sex offender. He was discovered watching child pornography, and how she's not just done therapy, but she's written and starred in a Broadway play on the matter. Enjoy the show. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. China and the United States, the world's biggest economic powers, are ramping up their trade war again. President Trump has promised to impose another $200 billion of tariffs by the end of this week unless Beijing comes to his table and meets his demands. A top-level Chinese delegation is due in Washington this week amid falling stock prices and new uncertainties about the global economy. But while negotiators focus on the dollars and cents, they're ignoring the flesh and blood as human rights disappear from the discussion, particularly the suffering of China's Muslim minority. 11 million Uyghurs live almost entirely in the western Xinjiang region. Human rights groups warn that China's Han majority government is trying to obliterate their culture and assimilate them. And last week, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of Defense accused Beijing of putting as many as 3 million Uyghurs in concentration camps, something Beijing vehemently denies. We're going to explore China's massively expanding surveillance apparatus and how it's using it to control its ethnic minority. Uyghurs want their human rights linked to trade talks, but that's not happening. And just reporting their story is an almost impossible task, as correspondent Matt Rivers found out in his journey across Xinjiang.
The bedroom hasn't changed since they left. Stuffed animals on the bed, their clothes in the closet. Their grandmother won't change it. She says it still smells like them. Ansila and Nusila, ages 8 and 7, left their home in Kazakhstan to go to China with their mother, Adiba, in 2017. Adiba grew up in China, so she went back for a short visit to see some family and take a few classes in Xinjiang in northwest China. Her husband, Yestin, and young son, Nurmaken, stayed home. But shortly after they arrived, Adiba and her daughters disappeared because they went back at the wrong time. Xinjiang is the region where the U.S. says China has put up to 2 million people, nearly all Muslims, in detention camps over the last few years. Activists say Beijing has done that to try to eliminate Islam within its borders. And ex-detainees have told CNN they were tortured inside while undergoing political indoctrination. Adiba and her family are Muslim. Her husband, Yestin, says a relative told him his wife was put in such a camp while his daughters were sent to live with distant relatives. He hasn't heard from any of them in nearly 2 years. When he sees young women in the neighborhood, he calls them mama, Yestin says. He doesn't even know what his own mother looks like. China says these camps aren't prisons, but voluntary vocational training centers that are being used to not eliminate Islam generally, only Islamic extremism, but the government has linked to past terror attacks in the region. So authorities play propaganda videos like this one on state-run TV to show happy Muslims cheerfully learning. They interview some who have supposedly been, quote, reformed, steered away from a life of terrorism. But even if that's true, Yestin says that still does not explain why his wife was locked up. My wife is not a terrorist, he says. She has nothing to do with it. I can't express with words how much pain I feel when I think of her there. We asked Chinese authorities what happened to Adiba. They did not reply to our question. So we went to Xinjiang ourselves, to some of the most remote parts of China, traveling thousands of miles in all. We went to six places, both to see what is happening here and in one town to try and find Adiba. Ethnic Muslim minorities have lived here for centuries, Uyghurs, Kazakhs, and others, culturally distinct from the Han Chinese who dominate the rest of the country. But now, every day, they're forced to prove that they're not a threat to the state. Cameras watch their every move, in some places positioned every 50 meters. While Han Chinese regularly breeze through the myriad police roadblocks, anyone we saw who appeared to be a minority got stopped. Racial profiling appears rampant. But all that is likely still better than life for those that end up in places like this. Detention camps designed for Muslim ethnic minorities, like this one, outside the city of Kashgar. What China calls a job training site, to us, looked a lot more like a prison. High walls, barbed wire, guard towers, things multiple experts told CNN are telltale signs of detention centers. Images like this are rare. Few people have seen camps like this up close because China's government tries to prevent reporters like us from seeing them. A police officer soon reminded us of that fact.
What's happening here is that this police officer does not want us to film. But what we believe is that that's a camp right there. This is as close as we've been able to get. And right over there, we believe are family members, presumably, who could have family members inside that camp, and they're waiting to see them.
China says it has nothing to hide here. But not only do they obstruct attempts to film or go inside the camps, they also prevent us from speaking to those who know anything about them. We tried to talk to this man who just brought food to his brother, who he says is being held in the camp. But before we could ask about life inside, plainclothes security surrounded us and told the man to be quiet. There are camps like these all across Xinjiang. Nearly 1,000 miles away, we took a train to the city of Turpan to see another. Same type of prison-like walls, same kind of secrecy, and the minute after we arrive, same kind of police harassment.
Ma'am, can you tell me what that is? Is this something that you don't want us to see?
Why you are here? You tell me why you're here. Why you're here?
We're here to film what we believe is a camp for Uyghurs and for Kazakhs and for Kyrgyz and for all ethnic Muslim minorities.
Who told you that?
She threatened to arrest us and demanded we delete our footage, so we had to leave. Our last stop is the town of Tuoli, where Adiba's family says she was detained. Her husband, Yestin, believes she has since been let out of the camp and is back living with her daughters. But Yestin was told they can't leave China because officials took away Adiba's passport. He has no way to contact her and fears he could end up in a camp himself if he went to find her. So we tried to find Adiba ourselves. But as soon as we arrive in town, traffic police block our way, and officials who'd been following us insist on a group dinner. We declined strongly, saying no, no, no. But in the end, we've got no choice. As Muslim minorities languish in camps not far away, government officials drink liquor and dance to folk music. It is an absurd scene, but we can't leave. And so we were unable to find Adiba, and we couldn't deliver this message, what Yestin wanted us to share if we found her. Quote, "Our son and I have been waiting and will always wait for you. You are the love of my life." Matt Rivers, CNN, Xinjiang, China.
It is Orwellian, isn't it? And let's turn now to Paul Mosher. He's the technology correspondent for The New York Times, based in Shanghai. He, too, has been to Xinjiang province, and he's been investigating how China is using technology against its people, particularly the Uyghurs. This is the deep dive into the technology aspect of it. Paul Mosher, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
We've just seen how correspondent Matt Rivers was systematically and serially prevented and obstacles put in his way when he's trying to get the truth or any answers as to what's going on behind those high walls and that barbed wire. You yourself have reported also that it's just really almost impossible to get right to the heart of the story. Tell me what you've experienced on the road.
Yeah, so when you get there, you know, we were mostly in Kashgar, and in Kashgar, they're pretty professional about this. So they have teams of about 7 secret police per journalist. So when I was first there, I had a team of 7 just following me every day. And then once my colleague Chris Buckley joined me, he had another 7. So we had 14 people kind of just walking alongside us everywhere we went. And when you get in a car, they follow you in cars. When you go down a road that could lead to a camp or starts to get to a camp, you see cars kind of slam on the brakes and cut you off. You know, you see spike strips get thrown out. But you're sort of under this sort of suffocating, sort of constant, you know, secret police presence. They would follow us into the bathrooms. You know, and then you have these checkpoints, and the checkpoints are kind of the bane of Uyghurs' everyday life on the ground. You know, every 300 or so yards, you're going to run into a checkpoint. And when we would run into them, they would make us, you know, open up our phones. They might look at our social media. They might go through our photos and delete photos. You know, and at one point, my colleague had a picture of a camel, and a police officer, a very stern police officer, kind of wanted to make a point. So he deleted the camel. And then he said, in China, there are no whys when we protested. So you're just sort of from every angle getting hit. And it, you know, it gives you, you know, it's not truly what the Uyghurs are living under, but it gives you a bit of a sense of it. And it really is overwhelming.
Well, it sounds absolutely overwhelming. I've honestly never heard of one journalist and 7 secret police. That is just a remarkable escalation in their control and their surveillance. But what you've also unearthed is the scale and the scope of an expanding surveillance state, and particularly when it comes to the Uyghurs. How did you discover this? What made you probe this, you know, use of technology to almost redesign their surveillance state?
Yeah, I mean, so it's something that's been going on in China more broadly for quite a few years. Now, if you left China maybe 5 or 6 years ago and came back today, probably the most sort of obvious change in the landscape, the urban landscape, are just these sort of, you know, sort of towers of cameras that have been assembled on a lot of intersections, different places. So that investigation led us obviously to Xinjiang, but it also led us to kind of look more broadly within China about what they're doing with this footage. And what we discovered is that they're starting to run computer vision and facial recognition algorithms that are marking people based on their race, based on whether they might have a history of mental illness, based on a past history of drug use, based on their discontent with the government. And once you sort of, what happens is on a local level, you have small lists of people's faces being assembled by local police, and then they can program the cameras to try and to send an alarm if somebody of that type walks by, and then the police know where they are, or maybe the police can respond and get them away from a certain area that they don't want them to be. So it's pretty stark in that respect. You know, and then that led us to Xinjiang, where you see the entire, you know, the entire world of the place reworked by technology with the help of technology, in terms of the cameras, but also the checkpoints, you know, the biometric collection of data, you know, DNA samples, face scans, iris scans, voice samples, all these ways that they're just trying to kind of, you know, get a more high-tech ability to know what every single person in this region is doing at all times.
So Xinjiang is where the Uyghurs' essential homeland is. There's some, I mean, they're a minority, but remember, we're in China, and apparently that minority adds up to 11 million people. I mean, they can't detain and put into re-education camps 11 million people. What is their aim with this technology and with the detention camps?
Right. So nobody is going to come out and say the aim. You know, for years they denied the existence of these camps, and now they're saying, well, they're just vocational training centers. So we have to kind of guess at the goals. But certainly, you know, any kind of analysis would show that basically they are trying to fundamentally alter Uyghur culture, and in some ways just stamp it out entirely and make this minority a lot more like all the rest of the Chinese everywhere else. And so, you know, you see specific targeting of Islam and you know, expressions of religion. You see any kind of Uyghur culture has to be sort of mediated in a very specific state-approved way. And so at the heart of it, these camps are about cultural transformation, about changing a minority in this just, you know, profound way. And, you know, whether they'll be successful or not is sort of hard to say. But certainly, even with just 1 million people in camps, that's a powerful enough deterrent that people are terrified in the way they live their day-to-day lives. You know, spontaneous expressions of culture are just much harder to come by now. And people have kind of been cowed into a fear. So in a way, you don't have to lock up 12 million. You know, you can, if you lock up 1 million, that's enough to sort of, you know, put a lot of fear in the rest of the population. And also, also what you can do with it and what they've done effectively is kind of destabilize the trust that knits together these communities. So, you know, if you're worried about your neighbor ratting you out or informing on you, or, you know, somebody else goes to a camp and they get out and you don't know why, you know, you sort of stop trusting people. So you see all these things going on. And the camps are just kind of a part of it. The camps are just the kind of, you know, one of the sticks, one of the levers they can pull to put that fear and control that population.
Let's just, for the sake of reminding people, talk about the Uyghurs, the Muslim minority there, and what the Chinese have thought about them in the past. I mean, to wit, the Chinese ambassador to Washington said that Beijing would retaliate in proportion if Washington went ahead with sanctions. And he said the aim was to re-educate a group it considers terrorists. Put that into perspective. What does it mean, terrorists? Has there been terrible trouble up there?
Yeah, so the history of this goes back a ways. The first thing you have to kind of understand is there's been this massive demographic change in Xinjiang. Xinjiang has been under Chinese control for several hundred years. Under the Chinese Communist Party, there's been this intentional system of sending ethnic Chinese to the region. So it was for a long time the homeland of the Uyghurs, and mostly just Uyghurs and ethnic Kazakhs live there. You go from maybe 5% of the population being Chinese 50 years ago to 50% today. So you have this huge intentional demographic shift, and that causes a lot of tensions. Meanwhile, you know, party policies do tend to sort of focus on, you know, pressuring people not to practice their religion and so on. So a lot of this, you know, it kind of turned the place into a tinderbox. And so in 2009, we get this this sort of race riot, effectively, in the capital of Urumqi, where, you know, a viral video of two Uyghur men being beaten to death in a Chinese factory spreads through Xinjiang. People march, things get out of control, and then Uyghurs kill about 200 Han Chinese in the streets of Urumqi. But what it looks like is not so much terrorism in the sense of a sort of, you know, the way that the Chinese government portrays it, which is this sort of fundamental Islamic influence and terrorism. It's much more a kind of a struggle for the survival of a culture and sort of a pushback against these Chinese rules.
When you talk about trying to destroy this culture and the importation of Han Chinese, ethnic Chinese, it reminds me a lot of what's going on in Tibet. I don't know whether you think there's a similarity there, but also, some of the aspects that trigger surveillance, you know, talk a little bit about that. I mean, using the word feminism or certain things that they hear people talking about on the telephone or whatever it might be. And it just seems like China is going all the way back to a repression that hasn't been seen since Mao's days.
So just on the Tibet point real quick. So the person who is in charge of Xinjiang at the moment, this guy Chen Quanguo, he led Tibet before. And a lot of the policies that he started with in Tibet, he's kind of perfected in Xinjiang. In terms of how people are being watched and what, you know, in Xinjiang, it's just overwhelming, right? There's really, the government needs no reason. And in most cases, most family members of people who have been taken to the camps aren't even necessarily aware of why they were taken away. I mean, to not have a smartphone can be suspicion enough. So people were switching to flip phones because the surveillance was so intense. And so to switch to a flip phone was kind of basically used as implied guilt. And people were taken away for that. To have a beard, to read the Quran, to discuss religion was, you know, considered generally a problem. And so you can no longer really speak honestly or trust anybody around you. And so we have an example where a parent told their child about the Quran. The child went to school and talked about the Quran, and the next day the parent was disappeared. So, you know, this is a level of control that sort of penetrates into how families are operating and how people talk to their neighbors. I mean, it's truly staggering how much these controls have crept in. You know, and Xinjiang is by far the most extreme. In the rest of China, it's harder to get away with it because you have a large middle class who will push back if you push too hard, and people who have power of their own within the system. But at the same time, just slowly, we see more and more draconian measures being, you know, imposed on the society via technology.
So essentially what we're talking about is the expansion of sort of government by surveillance. I just want to play a little bit of a clip of a documentary for the New York Times that you also took part in about, you know, who is Big Brother behind all these, you know, hundreds and thousands and however many cameras they've just installed there.
Most of the time, it's just police watching on the other end of these cameras. But the idea is that, one day soon, artificial intelligence will be able to automate that job, analyzing the day-to-day lives of hundreds of millions of citizens. You might think, well, that's just China. But it's not only in China. See that? That camera is in Ecuador.
So that's where it gets even more scary, right, Paul? I mean, how many countries and why Ecuador? Why are they, you know, rushing to get this particular kind of technology from China?
Right. So the big thing you notice with these exports are just camera networks. I mean, that's like the kind of major way that if you go to China, the place is blanketed in cameras. And so what we start seeing is these cameras appearing elsewhere, Ecuador, for instance. And it's dozens and dozens of countries, as far as we can tell. I mean, it could be as many as 50 countries have bought these kind of comprehensive surveillance systems from Chinese companies, backed by Chinese loans. So, you know, this is kind of the Belt and Road Initiative, right? So China has all these big infrastructure projects. They're spending money in a place like Nigeria or Kenya or Ecuador. And, you know, they give you a $2 billion loan for a dam. And they say, well, for $200 million, you can also get this countrywide camera network. And so a lot of countries are saying, yeah, let's do that. In Ecuador's case, there was a big crime problem and there was a real need to bring in security. But the question is, buying a $250 million camera network, is that really the best way to address Ecuador's crime problem? And in Ecuador, we saw a lot of people actually had experiences in front of cameras where they, you know, the police didn't come. They might be mugged in front of a camera and nothing happened. And so then what we found is that actually the domestic intel group within Ecuador, which was following and intimidating political opponents of the previous president, also had access to those cameras and was using them to follow people, to spy on political marches, all kinds of stuff like that. And we know there's a similar camera network in Venezuela, where obviously there's massive protests and kind of, you know, we're dealing with real political upheaval at the moment. Bolivia has one. Angola has one. We know Pakistan has something similar. The Philippines is putting one. And even in Iraq, we're seeing these Chinese surveillance systems go in. So it's spreading in a very real way. And it's a lot of it is actually funded by the Chinese government. And so after the cameras, next comes the facial recognition. And all of a sudden, if you're a country where there's no protections, you could put facial recognition that targets a racial group and tells you every time a certain racial group goes to a certain place, or every time five people of that ethnicity, go into a square. And so you can start really adding these things up. And Chinese companies are hard at work on all of this. And we know there will be funding right there from the Chinese government to help countries buy this. And so it's a very real issue.
Wow. It really is mind-boggling. Amazing. Paul Mosher, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.
And it really is social engineering on a sinister scale. And in a world that can often seem like it's facing multiple crises at once, which countries handle them best? Jared Diamond has a fascinating mind, and he's frankly a lot of things. He's a polymath, a biologist, a geographer, a linguist, and a historian. His million-copy bestseller, Guns, Germs, and Steel, won the Pulitzer Prize in 1998, and now he's back with another book called Upheaval, Turning Points for Nations in Crisis, about what makes certain nations more resilient, looking at history, geography, biology, anthropology, but also now psychology. Why? Well, let's ask him. He's joining me from New York. Jared Diamond, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Here I am.
Here you are. Now, I am interested in the psychology aspect, and I wonder whether you might just start by perhaps putting it into context with what we've just seen, this unbelievable crackdown and surveillance state in China.
Sure. The issues of national crises, China faces its own problems, and it's dealing with its problems. But national crises, all countries face crises. The United States is spiraling into one today. And when I reflect on the countries in which I've lived during my 81 years of life, Germany, Indonesia, Australia, Finland, Chile, Japan, they've all either had or been experiencing or been going into crises while I was there. It's not that I caused the crises, it's that crises are common among nations. Well, my wife is a clinical psychologist. Marie did a specialty in a branch of clinical psychology called crisis therapy, helping people deal with personal crises, such as breakdowns of marriages and deaths of loved ones and career setbacks. And as Marie talked to me about the outcome predictors that help understand whether or not a person will respond to a personal crisis and change in a constructive way, it dawned on me that nations also react to crises in ways that in many respects are similar to how people respond to personal crises.
So let's drill down. Show me a sort of a case study of that, because it's really interesting. I mean, bringing sort of a very personal, psychological element to trying to resolve national crises and problems. I mean, let's just take America. Not one of the countries you studied, because you listed the six. But what crisis do you identify, and what's the psychology of it?
Sure. I discussed six crises that have unfolded in six nations where one can draw the conclusions. But my book concludes by looking at four crises in the process of unfolding where we cannot yet say what the outcome is. Japan today, the United States today, and the world today. In the case of the United States, the problems that the United States now faces are familiar to Americans. They are the deterioration of political compromise, the restrictions on voting that mean the decline of American democracy, increasing inequality, and decreasing government investment. What might lead us to hope for a good outcome for the United States, and what might lead us to hope for a bad outcome? Well, people derive confidence from crises met previously. The United States has a long track record of having dealt successfully with difficult things such as World War II and the Civil War. That gives one optimism for the United States. Something giving one pessimism for the United States is that people can get through personal crises by using other people as models. When my first marriage broke down, I went out and talked to friends who had gotten divorced and learned from my friends about how they had conducted their marriages more successfully. The United States has a belief in what's called American exceptionalism. The belief that the United States is exceptional is so different from any other country that there's nothing that we can learn from another country. But the fact is that the United States is wrestling with problems of education and health and prisons and development, problems that face Canada and Western Europe and Japan, other democracies, and yet we refuse to learn from our neighbor Canada and from Western European countries in the belief that we are so unique that there's nothing we can learn, even when other countries are dealing more successfully with these problems.
That's really interesting. And you also sort of lay it out in a sort of a 12-step process, which is very AA, isn't it? I mean, it is something that many people in those kinds of dire straits are familiar with. And you say that there's certain, you know, factors that you have to actually accept. For instance, you say, acknowledge that one is entering a crisis, acceptance of responsibility, honest self-appraisal. How do you rate the United States on those three factors?
On those three factors, I have to rate the United States today as not doing very well. Many Americans, perhaps most Americans, don't yet acknowledge that we are spiraling into a crisis. The next step in dealing with a personal crisis or a national crisis is to acknowledge that you can do something about it. You have responsibility. It's not just pitting yourself as a victim of those bad people or bad countries out there. But in the United States today, there's too much talk about what China and Mexico and Canada are doing. But there's no way that China, Mexico, or Canada can bring an end to American democracy. The only people who can bring an end to American democracy are we Americans. So there's that denial of responsibility. Mm-hmm. And then once again, the issue that I mentioned of declining to look to other countries for models, those are all things that could make one pessimistic about the United States. But they are also the things that can make me optimistic.
And just to put a not too fine a point on it, you also say that unlike some of the other countries that you've examined, the United States has not faced a crushing defeat or an occupation, such as whether it was Japan or France, in World War II. How does that factor in to the U.S. resilience or not in a time of great crisis?
Interesting question. One way that I think it factors in is that if you've been defeated and it's taken you a long time to dig out, as has been the case for Germany after World War II, you got to be patient. Germany was partitioned after World War II. That was, 1945 onwards. And Germany did not get reunified until 1990, 45 years later. Germans had to be patient. There was nothing they could do to bring about their unification. Americans tend not to be patient. We were impatient about, in effect, our military defeat in the Vietnam War. We're somewhat impatient today. So patience is a quality that doesn't characterize Americans. Instead, we have a can-do attitude and we expect quick success.
Well, I want to dig down a little bit on that because, you say that some crises build over a long time. I mean, you talked about divorce in a personal situation. But I spoke to the economist Paul Romer, or a Nobel Prize winner, and he said, for instance, about the climate crisis, which clearly has been building over a long, long time, the following regarding patience. Just have a listen to this.
Here, I think one has to be patient. This is a problem that's been getting worse for, more than a century. It'll continue to be a problem in the future. Those of us who produce suggestions about ways to address it and mechanisms, we just have to be patient, keep kind of beating the drum on this. At some point, the chance will emerge for the politicians to say, okay, now's the time to do this. And that will come. We just have to keep persisting.
Do you agree with that we can afford to be patient about some crises until the right moment comes, for instance, in this, existential crisis of ongoing climate change?
I agree half with you. I agree that there are some things about which we need to be patient. Germany had to be patient about waiting for unification. And there are other things about which, no, we should not be patient. The time is now. Climate change is a good example. There's no reason why there's every reason not to be patient about continuing to let the climate change crisis build up. And again, we can use an analogy to a marriage. If a marriage is deteriorating and it's continuing to deteriorate, this is not the time to tell your husband, dear, let's be patient. Our marriage is going downhill, but we are not in a crisis. Let's wait for it to get really bad. No, there are times to be patient and times not to be patient.
Going back to sort of tolerance and that I think you identify as one of the big crises, the intolerance and the divisiveness in American society, you attribute quite a lot of it to a declining face-to-face communications. Expand on that a bit.
Yeah, it's striking that political compromise and tolerance of different points of view are declining in the United States. Why? Is this purely a political phenomenon? Well, there's a decline in compromise in American academic life among scholars, the world that I live in. There's a decline in tolerance just socially, generally, in the United States. There's a decline in tolerance in getting out of elevators. When I grew up, you let people come out of elevators before you rush in. Nowadays, people rush into elevators in the United States. So I see a general decline in social civility in the United States. Why? Because I do so much of my work on the island of New Guinea, where societies are traditional, and people engage with each other face-to-face, no cell phones, no telephones, no radio, no television. You look at someone in the face, you read their body language, you can smell them, you experience another person as a person. In the United States, and increasingly in the first world, we experience other people as words on a screen. But it's easier to be rude and abusive to words on a screen than to be abusive to another human who's sitting 2 feet away from you and you're talking to him. So I see part of the reason for decline in civility in the United States as being the proliferation of non-face-to-face communication. But then you respond, well, in Japan and Italy and Germany, there are also cell phones. Yes, that's true. The United States is bigger. We are 3,000 miles coast to coast. We move every 5 years. When Americans move, they move beyond the range of their original friends. So friendships, social interactions are shallower in the United States than in other countries. I just come back from Italy, and I'm really struck that in 2 weeks in Italy, I have more social life than in a year in the United States. Those are the two factors that I see as possibly responsible for the decline in civility, including political civility in the United States.
So let me ask you, because that's quite a profound and interesting observation at this point. You have also weighed in about compromises and trade-offs that citizens of certain nation-states, city-states, nations have to make? You've looked at Singapore, for instance. What are the compromises and trade-offs for a good life that you've identified?
Singapore, interesting country, interesting city, but it's a city that is a country. Singapore is a tiny nation, city, state, wedged between two giants, Malaysia and Indonesia. Singapore detached itself or was in effect expelled from Malaysia 50 or 60 years ago. Singapore found itself in a difficult situation. It still gets its water and much of its food from Malaysia. And next door is Indonesia with a strong military. How is Singapore going to be able to maintain a path between these two giants? The Singapore government realized we cannot make mistakes. We cannot let our citizens shoot off their mouths and insult Malaysia or Indonesia. That's going to ruin our country. And so Singapore micromanages its citizens. There are monitors to monitor the movements of cars. What most impressed me on my recent visit to Singapore was a Singapore city official who explained that they're installing monitors to monitor not just energy consumption, electricity consumption in every apartment, but also the flushing of toilets. In Singapore, we Americans would say, for the government to monitor the flushing of my toilets, that's an intolerable intrusion on my privacy. Yeah. But in Singapore, there is a compromise. The citizens accept that there's a compromise. They give up individual freedoms in order to have a rich and healthy life. Mm-hmm. To Americans, that's intolerable.
And you know what? For a whole nother segment, we'll leave the issue of flushing toilets and why that is important in this debate. But Jared Diamond, thank you very much indeed for joining us. And now we turn to a very difficult subject. The victims of child pornography are, of course, the children, many of whom carry feelings of suffering and shame that can last a lifetime. And child pornography, those who view it on the internet, actually increase the illicit trade. That has only grown stronger in recent years. On the other side of this painful crime sit the families of the perpetrators, wives, children, mothers, who must grapple with the reality that someone they love was watching child pornography. This is what happened to actress Maddie Corman when her husband of two decades was arrested on child pornography charges in 2015. After going through years of therapy, Corman then went a step further. She wrote and performed a one-woman play about her experience called Accidentally Brave. And she's been talking to our Michelle Martin, discussing the complicated path to forgiveness and her decision to stay with her husband, who is now a registered sex offender and on 10 years probation.
Maddie Corman, thanks so much for talking to us.
Of course.
Just briefly, if you would.
Yeah.
Just for people who don't know the story, give us the...
Yeah, and I still, by the way,
the short version of,
you know, as much as now I'm used to doing the show eight times a week, this still, I still get the tightness in my chest, and I have my fake lashes on and my hair done, and I still feel like a little scared.
And I'm sorry
kid.
To have to ask you.
I mean,
I
wrote the damn thing. Mm-hmm. My husband, a few years ago, late July. I'll just tell it the way it happened to me, because I do say that in the play. I try to tell my story, not my kid's story, not my husband's story. But so I was driving to work at 5 in the morning. I am an actress, so I was going to shoot a TV show, a guest spot. And my phone rang, and it was my daughter screaming. And I couldn't understand what was going on. And the police were in my house, and they were seizing our computers, and they had found child pornography, or at least evidence of child pornography, on my husband's laptop. I didn't even comprehend I didn't even understand at first what was going on, why they were there, what they had found. I wanted it to be a mistake.
And you found out it wasn't?
It wasn't a mistake.
And not only was it not a mistake, you confronted him. You said,
oh,
is this true? And he said...
Yes. Mm-hmm. And my heart just... My heart sank, my stomach fell. I can feel it now, and I do feel it was unbelievable.
To your knowledge, he never touched a child or harmed a child.
To my knowledge, he never touched or harmed a child or a person.
Do you draw a distinction between watching and
I
doing?
I do. Mm-hmm. I know that some people don't, mm-hmm. but I absolutely do. And that was an important thing to me to find out. I asked him, but I more than just asked him. There were polygraphs involved. There was forensic evidence, making sure that both for legally, but also for me, mm-hmm. There were no chat rooms. There was no texting. There was no contact. This was a very, very private, secret mm-hmm. activity for him.
That does he acknowledge, though, that the viewing of child pornography creates a market for child pornography, which means somebody is going to be inducing a child or touching a child?
Yeah.
Does he accept that?
Yes, as do I. And we both would say it is absolutely not a victimless crime. And I'm not talking about me and my kids. Absolutely. And not taking the moral out of it, putting it back in. I have said to him, I just can't believe. And he would say, I feel the same way. It is against everything I believe. It is not who I am. It is not what I want.
You know what's so hard about this is that, because your husband is a very distinguished director, mm-hmm. right? Very highly regarded. Mm-hmm. And also, by your accounting, a great dad. I mean,
yeah,
really
way more so than... than what,
just doing all kinds of, you know.
And we were a good team. Like, we weren't in this.
So it's just hard to understand how somebody who, you know, respects, loves, and wants to support kids is then involved in seeing other kids being treated in a way that is could be damaging forever. It's hard to understand.
It's hard for me to understand, too. And it's taken me a long time, and I will tell you the truth that a couple days ago I was at couples therapy still talking about the same thing, and I don't know that I will ever fully understand it. There is a compartmentalization that addiction seems to bring out, and that people can have a part of their life that is completely separate and do things that they swore they would never do. Mm-hmm. Pornography has its own special brand of addiction where I think that even if you're not viewing children, which is obviously just horrible, but even if you're viewing something legal, I would say now that with what I've learned, that a lot of people look at things that they would not actually mm-hmm. be okay with doing in real life.
You had no clue, because I know a lot of people are going to ask that. I mean, I know a lot of people did ask that. Did you have any idea? Yeah. Did you in any way think, or did you suspect? And you were like, no.
He was a great, and
husband,
is a great person with some issues, but certainly I didn't know this, and I didn't know he was watching pornography, mm-hmm. which is, I have a lot of shame about that. We never talked about it. It wasn't a part of our romantic life. It wasn't something, and yet we are not super religious or super conservative. And this is part of the recovery for me and part of the putting my history back together. That is a whole other thing that partners of sex addicts, or I would say any addicts, have to go through, or anybody whose partner has kept a secret from them. I know the topic is salacious and exciting, but if we put that aside for a minute, it's putting back together your history and going, wait, mm-hmm. but we joked about that. We were not precious about that. You are a person who's funny and could, you know, make jokes about sex and things. We weren't like, let's not talk about that.
How on earth did you come up with the idea of making a play out of the worst, not just day, but months of your life?
When I received this news and I was lying on the bathroom floor and I was, the last thing on my mind was, you know what I should do? I should make this into a one-woman show and maybe star in it. No, I was just like, how can I get the kids to school? How can I go to the market and see the fewest people possible and not start crying when I'm at the checkout? Like, I was just, and I was in triage, you know, it was one thing at a time, 1 minute at a time, putting my oxygen mask on, mm-hmm, then
breathe.
Putting it on the kids, sometimes putting it on them, falling down, remembering to put it back on myself. So that was the last thing on my mind. But about a year and a half ago, I had come up for air. I wouldn't say I was fine, because I still don't say I'm fine, but I was feeling a little bit more stable, and I thought, I think maybe possibly I'd like to write about this.
Did you think, I'm going to actually tell my story myself, or was it more, I just got to get something down on paper because I have to?
I thought I had some need to tell the story, mostly because the way that I got off the metaphoric and literal bathroom floor that I was falling on over and over again was through someone sharing her story with me, the truth, the messy, the ugly, the heartache, the anger, the love, all of it. And she was kind enough, a stranger.
The person you call your angel.
Yes.
Somebody who really steps up for you, yeah. And you've never named.
She read a story in the New York Post, which, by the way, mm-hmm. if I had read that story, I would have said, ugh. And she read that story, and she saw past the headlines and the details and said, there's a family that must be hurting so badly, and I believe that I can be of service. And she found me, and I am forever grateful. And I don't know that I would be okay had she not. And it helped me so much, more than any of the therapy and any of the friends and amazing family support that I had. It was this stranger telling me her story.
And then you committed to sharing your worst day.
Yeah.
8 times a week. And I just have to ask, you know, what is that like?
You know, one of my sons said to me the other day, Mom, are you having fun doing the show? Because I love doing plays. And I said, that is not the word I would use. But it is fulfilling sometimes. I'm in group therapy with other partners of sex addicts, and I would dread when we would get a new person, when someone would leave and we'd bring in a new person, because that meant I had to tell my story again, and I had to see your face when I tell you my story, because I had so much shame and the trauma of the way my story unfolded, which was an arrest first thing in the morning. My kids were there. I wasn't there. I mean, there's so much. And the shock of it being a total surprise and secret revealed, and then it being in the newspaper within 24 hours. And I started to see there was some method to the madness of my therapist actually wanting new people to come in and encouraging us to tell our stories once again and not reliving the trauma, but reexamining what it is to share what happened to you.
What's going to be hard for some people to believe is that the play is hilarious. I just have to assert that it's hilarious.
Thank you.
And I know that that's going to be a hard thing for some people to hear, because, like, how the heck can that
gallows humor sometimes.
But I want to play a clip from the play where you are, I guess we'd call it, it's at family therapy,
family week at rehab.
He goes to rehab while he's awaiting the disposition of his legal case, right?
Yes.
And you didn't want to go, and you go through this sort of array of emotions, but let me just play this clip, and this is where you decide that you're going to go to family week, and you're telling us a little bit about how it goes down. So here it is. Okay. Let's play it.
And I learn that my husband has some more secrets. Things that happened to him long before I met him. And hearing him share those secrets makes me really sad, but also really angry, because I'm me. I shared everything with you. How could you not trust me with that? And we learn about shame and abuse. And I ask him why he couldn't just have an affair like a normal person. And we do ropes courses. And even though we aren't supposed to talk about the future, I break the rules and I tell him I will never, ever be okay with the things that you chose to look at. And we all wish that our partners had been struck by any one of the way cooler, more socially acceptable compulsions.
I'm curious about whether before this thing happened to your family, if you read something in the paper or if you saw that somebody had been arrested for something, was there a part of you that was like, wow, that person is...
Yes.
I mean, there's something in you that had to be like, wow, I looked at these things very differently or before.
No. Yes, absolutely. And I think it's one of the reasons I was so scared and continue to be so scared, because I know, or I made up in my head, what people would think and what I thought. And going to Family Week was a huge deal. Not everyone at this rehab was there for the same reason. But I met people who had done other kinds of unspeakable things, and they became human to me.
I'm not going to lie. It really helps that all of the ladies here at Family Week are beautiful, smart, and ferocious, and they are entrepreneurs and professors and moms and models, and bad shit still happens to them. And I meet their husbands, doctors, generals, musicians, rabbis, and they are not evil trolls at all. And I start to feel something that I can't quite put into words, but it is compassion, which I can't feel for my own partner, at least not yet.
Well, this play really has to be in part about forgiveness, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. And I think there's acceptance and there's forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And for me, I had to come to a place of saying, this happened. I'm not going to change it. That doesn't mean I'm okay with it. It also doesn't mean my husband's okay with it.
Spoiler alert, you do stay together.
Yeah.
And I think many people might be wondering, like, what was that like? What was that process like?
Early on, it was triage. It was, we got to put one thing in front of the other. I don't know what's happening. I don't know. I can't even see. The last thing I need is to, I actually said to my therapist, well, I just want to run away. And she said, okay, you can run away, but the pain's going with you.
Mm.
So I'm not telling you what to do, but you can't run away from the pain. You can run away from that guy, but you're still going to have to do the work. So my suggestion is don't make any big decisions for the next 6 months. Just take a breath, deal with your kids, deal with all the legal stuff that's going on. Let him go to rehab. You do your work, and let's... Because I loved my husband. I didn't... I had 20 years with a person who I loved. So I needed a minute to catch up. There was no big moment where I said, okay, I'm definitely staying. It just... I also had to see. I had to see what he showed up with.
You said you loved him. Do you still love him?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. I do. I think I said it in the past because it was never a controversial or shameful thing to say how much I loved my husband.
How's he doing?
Well, I would say you have to ask him.
Mm-hmm.
But he's okay. He, too, is pretty... The other day I said to him, you know, I'm really... it may not seem like it, but no one's really harder on him than I am. I mean, I have been, I put a little bit of it in the play, but if there were a camera on me, there have been some pretty tough moments, and I've said some pretty harsh things. And the other day, I just had a moment because maybe a magazine came or something. I don't know. There was something where I said, you know, you've lost a lot. I don't acknowledge it a lot. I don't give you this a lot, but you've lost a lot, you know.
What's been the worst part of this whole experience?
Oh, the worst part, I mean, not to be specific, but the worst part is just that my kids are hurt and that my kids, more than just hurt, because I think that there's some good that can come out of seeing, if I put it on a holistic level and say, seeing your parent fall and seeing that parent get back up is not the worst thing in the world.
Has he seen the play?
He did see the play. He snuck in. We had an agreement because we have no more secrets anymore. I mean, please God. So he said, I'm going to see the play. And I said, I don't think you should see the play. And he said, I'm going to see the play and I'm telling you. But I'm not going to tell you when because I don't think you could do the play if you knew I was there. And I said, that's true. And So he did.
Any reviews?
Well, I said, how was that for you? And he said it was really hard. And about midway through, he said, I'm aware every day of the hurt that I have caused. My family, my community, the victims. I think about it every day. I'm not in denial of what I did. But this was a new refresher course in how much pain I've caused you and the kids. And that was really, really painful. And then he said, at some point I was able to separate myself enough to say, my wife created something beautiful and important and funny, and that I'm proud of you. And then he said, and I have a couple of notes.
I bet.
And I said, I don't want to hear your notes.
Exactly.
And then in the middle of the night, I said, what are the notes?
Maddie Corman, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It was really nice to talk to you.
Likewise. Thank you.
Happy to meet you.
Mm-hmm. And that's our show for now. Remember, you can always listen to our podcast and see us online at amanpour.com. And you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter. Thanks for watching and goodbye from London.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.